My name is Chris Mann. I'm with Admiral Richard H. Leier, L-E-I-R, and we're in, I guess, Pat Bay, just outside of Victoria, B.C. The date today is June 14, 1978. Admiral Leier, I was wondering if you could tell us where you were born and a bit about your brief family background and what your family did and other family people who were in services, things like that.
I was born into a very large family in Penticton, B.C. in 1921. I'm the oldest boy of 11 children, with three brothers and seven sisters. My father, an early pioneer in the Okanagan, was in lumber, some cattle, and some fruit in the southern Okanagan. I was educated for the first eight grades in the Penticton Elementary and Junior High School, and then was sent for my sins to Shawnigan Lakes Boys School, where I finished my education and took grade 13. Towards the end of my time at Shawnigan, I sat the naval exam because I had always wished to enter the Navy ever since I could remember. This desire arose from sailing boats in the Okanagan Lake, and later staying here at this home that I now own, which was built by my uncle. I used to come down every summer during the 30s and stay with him. He was a retired naval officer, ex-surveyor of this coast.
What was his name, sir?
Captain G.A.E. Willis. Willis Point. Up the top end of the Saanich Peninsula is Saanich Inlet is named after him. He served in Nigeria from 1898 till 1904 or 5 on this coast, while she was doing the surveys of the original Admiralty charts here. In fact, the name of the ship is chiseled into the rock in Bedwell Harbor. If you want to go look at it, and the date is 1903.
And the ship itself was the HMS.
Egeria.
Egeria.
He, late in life, married an aunt of mine late in life, and having no children, he took a shine to me, I guess. And so I spent summers here, mostly in his converted fishing boat, which we did the coast from here to Prince Rupert in long summer cruises. He, his library was full of pictures of battleships, telescopes. He talked much of the RN, and I took a great shine to that career. I announced to my father in 1932, at the age of 14, that I'd like to join the Navy, like all those people did in England, and he said, "We don't have one, I don't think." Anyway, he wrote to Ottawa to find out, and they said, "Yes, we do have a Navy, but your son can't join it until he is 17. So I bided my time till I was 17, and then wrote the first of the civil service exams in 1938, and failed hopelessly.
What were the exams like, sir?
It was a, it was about the standard of junior matric at that time, with a heavy load of mathematics, particularly a subject called spherical trigonometry, which nobody knew anything about. It was slightly loaded that way. Otherwise, it was purely a sort of about the equivalent of the civil service exam that I think still exists to get into things like external affairs. My son wrote one the other day.
Yes.
And it's that kind of a general test. It was followed by an interview. And as I say, I failed the first year, but I was lucky. My birthday was such that I got a second crack at it in 1939. By that time, I had finished senior matric, and I found the exam fairly simple. We sat, a bunch of us, in Oak Bay High School, wrote the exam with people like Ray Creary, who was the only other one that actually got into the service with me. This was followed by an interview in the dockyard at Squimalt.
You wouldn't happen to have a date on this, would you, sir?
This would be the late summer of 1939. The interview consisted of a very senior naval officer, whose name I cannot remember, the headmaster of a boys' school, I can't remember which, and Bishop Sextant, who was the Anglican bishop. Why Anglican, I don't know, but And I think there was one other member of the board, and it was a frightening experience. The first question I can remember being asked was, what color were the flowers on the entrance of the building that I'd come into? And I said I thought they were red, and I was relieved to see that when I went out after the interview, they were in fact geraniums. That was the sum total of the entry's requirement to get into the permanent force. It was to pass that civil service exam and pass that board and have a medical examination, which wasn't very thorough. And then I went back to Penticton and heard nothing.
You weren't put into an officer cadet position at all?
No, they didn't say yes or no. There were better than 130 applicants, I understand, that year, and they were only taking 7 executive officers.
I'm sorry, sir, I don't understand executive.
Well, there were executive, engineer, and supply were the three entrances. You entered as a cadet, either
right.
In the engineering, in the executive branch, or in the supply branch. The year I joined, they took a total of 12 or 13 of us, of which 7 were executive, and I wanted to be executive. I didn't know this until, of course, some months later. But I suppose they were culling over the lot. Better, as I know, there were more than 140 people sat. Doesn't sound like many, but it was quite large, I suppose, in those days. It's still being peacetime in Canada.
Was there a feeling that war was imminent at this time?
No, as far as I'm concerned, it was not. There was no question. There was no war feeling in British Columbia in that time. We were much too far away from it, or perhaps I was too young. And certainly there were no outward indications around the along the coast or in the town that there was a war coming. This was August 39, a month before it began. As I say, I heard nothing from Ottawa, and so I went on with my education. I had applied to UBC to be a mining engineer, and I was accepted, and so I turned up at UBC in September, registered in the engineering faculty, and started my studies, or did I? It was a very short time, about, I suppose, the middle of October. A brown envelope arrived saying, you're in.
This is after war.
War had been declared.
Now, what was your feeling at this point, then? Were you not...
I can remember before even leaving that I had been accepted, and I remember listening on the radio to the Exeter's fight with the Graf Spee in December of that year, because I hadn't left the... although I'd been accepted, they didn't say, they said, you'll have to wait for further instructions. As soon as I got accepted, I told the university that I'd rather be a naval officer than a mining engineer, and went home, waiting for instructions. As I say, we waited right down till Christmas. Early in the year, 1940, the instructions arrived, and I was told to proceed to Halifax. Just no uniform, no induction. I just simply...
A
travel warrant arrived. Yes, a travel warrant arrived and a letter saying, take the train to Halifax report to the naval base. With complete faith, I just climbed on the train and set out across Canada. Strange enough, picking up other members. There were 2 from Victoria here... both of which were killed in the Hood, Beard and Norman, Norm Beard and Chris Norman. And we met on the train, of course, and gradually the numbers swelled until time we reached Halifax. There were around 10 of us.
Why wouldn't you go to Pacific Coast Command? Were there not things happening here that they could use you for, or just...
I have no idea. I mean, the bureaucracy moves in a mysterious way. That's all they said. I presume they just inducted everybody to the nearest port. What they were doing, in fact, was shipping us direct to England. The instructions given was that I'd be sent to Dartmouth for training, despite the fact the war was on. I was being sent to the Frobisher, HMS Frobisher, the training ship. And the way they did that was that they went across to England as a civilian. I was already abducted, although I never swore or signed a piece of paper. I was an unsworn man. I literally joined this way.
Did you receive a commission in the mail?
No, I received nothing, except the instructions to go to Halifax, where we all arrived in civilian clothes with no uniforms because we were instructed to buy our uniforms from Guise when we arrived in England. We were then mustered in the barracks at HMCS Stadacona, given a pair of gaiters and a belt and a rifle, and we were told to remove our jackets and wear a sweater, and we started our parade ground training under the chief petty officer, waiting for the first convoy to take us to England, without uniform or anything. With no papers, no number, no ID card, no bureaucracy at all, just Lear and a bunch of us. It was the days before bureaucracy, and it's really quite incredible to think about it.
Now, this would be 1940, or is this Christmas or January?
This is about February 1940 by the time.
February 1940, so you're out at HMCS
Stadacona, living in the wardroom, without a uniform, called Mr. Lear, and... waiting, and about the end of, we did about 3 weeks training there, when the convoy with, I think it was the second contingent of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, the second loading, went across. It was a big
first division had already gone at this point.
Yeah, I think it was it was the second loading of the first division. I think
second
it was the
loading. Yeah,
I think. Anyway, there was a mass of soldiery. We were in the Drunken Duchess of Bedford, known as the Drunken Duchess as they rolled so much. Again, and we were all in civilian clothes, and nobody thought that was very peculiar. I remember we didn't seem to think that was peculiar. We were off to a kind of school, it never occurred to anybody that I think we were a rare group because we were caught in a kind of the haste of the starting of the war. But to this day, and to the day I retired, I was never sworn in. I was an unsworn man, and I suppose for that reason, technically, I could have walked out of the service any time and said, "Well, I don't belong to you anyhow." I don't know.
Technically,
oh yes, I suppose. We were then met in.
Excuse me, sir. Before you leave Halifax, now you said you had a couple of weeks training.
Maybe a month. It's hard to remember. Yeah, a couple of weeks.
February 1940. What a training for naval executive officers, cadets, or
cadets. Yeah,
naval cadet.
What did it consist of?
Yes.
Endless parade ground work. You know, all we did was we were put and drilled on the parade ground. I think we may have tied some knots, but it seems a long time ago. All I can remember is parading in that drill shed in the freezing cold, and in civilian clothes, not even a pair of boots, just our shoes.
You had to provide your own.
Well, we just...
What we had.
We were being kitted up when we got to England by, you know, himself, Mr. Gieves.
Mm-hmm.
Recollect very little of Halifax at that time.
Do you remember the food at all?
We lived at the wardroom, and, I thought it was having... I guess I was used to institutional food, having been a schoolboy in Shoreningham.
Yes.
It seemed great. I was seven, just touching eight, just 17, I guess. See, no, I was 18 that year, in November of that year. So everything was just fine as far as I was concerned. This is what I want to do all my life, and if this is what they said I was to do, that was what, it was great.
You didn't question the discipline or the orders or anything?
Never questioned anything. Just, you know, it seems another age. One didn't question anything.
Just didn't strike you as being odd that someone had the power of virtual life and death over you?
Never thought about it.
How about your colleagues at the time?
They didn't seem to either. We were still really schoolboys, I guess. Enjoying every minute of it, just loving it, just a great big adventure. Never knew what was going to happen next, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabethan spirit of adventure was strong in those days, I guess. So we traveled across the Atlantic in relative comfort, I remember. We lived in comfort.
What ship would this be now? This is the Bedford?
This is the Duchess of Bedford.
The Duchess of Bedford.
One of the old CPR Duchess boats.
Oh.
And we had... fairly good accommodation. I had a defense station of some sort. I can't remember what it was. Some place we had to muster every 6 hours.
I'm just wondering what kind of duties you would have as a cadet. Or were you just a cadet
passenger? Just a cadet passenger. It was, you know, the whole ship was full of passengers, and there were a lot of other civilian people in it. Government officials, I guess. Of course, lots of soldiers, and some airmen. And some lucky group, there were four in our group who had uniforms, who were from RMC.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also of my term. Peter Chance and Benny Benoit were two. Jones was a third, all from RMC, and they had uniforms. And they were
real. They had naval uniforms?
They were reserve midshipmen, and they had to drop their midshipmen and go back to being cadets. In order to enter, they had been VR midshipmen and had VR uniforms with a purple patch up here instead of the white.
Mm-hmm.
And they put all that down when they went back to the training ship. They went to the training ship as cadets with us. We're all the same group. So four of them had uniforms, which was a great envy.
I imagine.
But we bided our time.
So they had one thin stripe, I guess.
No stripes. A midshipman cadet wore no stripes, just a patch on the collar.
Just a patch.
The cadet just had
a
twist of white.
Had a thin, very thin
no,
stripe on
nobody,
the
No, nobody in those days, in the navies, all midshipmen have no stripes. You're not a commissioned officer. You don't get commissioned until you're a sub-lieutenant in those days.
Now,
of course, it's all different. They've got a stripe as a midshipman because it's equivalent to a second lieutenant. The midshipman and cadet, well, the midshipman was a rare kind of rank. You were a subordinate officer without a commission. You were lower, you know, you had less rights than the lowest able seaman.
You sir to everybody, or what?
Some people called you sir after they had given you a hard time. All the men called you sir because you wore an officer's cap. None of the officers took you seriously. You were sometimes doing men's work. Come to that later. As a midshipman, you were doing some menial tasks as well as officer tasks. It was very much like being a cadet. The cadet wore the brass-bound uniform with just two twists on the collar,
mm-hmm.
On each side, and a button or a twist. And the midshipman wore a white patch when he was promoted with the button and the twist on it. And that up here, and not till you became a sub-lieutenant were you commissioned an officer. That didn't mean to say they didn't use you endlessly as an officer. They could use you for anything, and did. We were met in London, and...
An uneventful crime.
Yes, nothing, saw nothing, except there was an old R-class, I think it was the Revenge, wallowing along. It was the first battleship I ever saw. Wallowing along in the middle of a convoy, which
did
was...
Did you feel very... that nothing could touch you with all
absolutely.
That.
Fantastic morale. Thought, you know, that this was going to be a skylark, you know. War wasn't hell at all. War was lots of fun. In fact, it seemed the whole of my war was lots of fun, which says a lot, I suppose, for the mentality. Even when it didn't look so good, one didn't recognize it was as bad as it was. So that was my...
Did you go into Garrick, Scotland now, or did
we went to? We were met in London officially by a Canadian naval officer.
Do you remember where you landed, though?
Oh yes, we landed at Liverpool.
Liverpool.
We took the train to London. We were clocked in or checked into HMCS Niobe, I think. Anyway, we were met by a Canadian officer and put in a hotel and. Went around almost immediately to Mr. Gieves, the great naval tailor, who already had all our measurements, because they enclosed a form when I joined, I forgot to say, saying, measure yourself and stick it on this piece of paper and mail it to Mr. Gieves, was one of the mm-hmm. instructions. So he had all your sizes, everything, and your uniforms were about ready, except for one fitting. And a complete cadet's kit, everything that you needed to be a cadet. Mr. Gieves knew.
The government would pay for this.
Oh,
time,
no,
right?
No. The government paid...
I thought only commissioned officers had to pay their own
kit. No, not only did you have to... You had to provide every bit of your kit at your own expense or your parents' expense. Your parents had to find the equivalent of £50 a year for your pocket money.
Like an apprenticeship type thing.
Yeah, and the government paid you 25 cents a day.
You got the worst of both worlds rather than the best.
Yeah, and out of that 25 cents, they took 3.5% for pension deductions. even at that time. And that, that lasted about 9 months. In the training.
Well, what was it like going to this London tailor? I mean, that must have been quite
the... Oh, this, you know, Mr. Gieves was a very high-class tailor, as you know, or a service tailor, and very deferent. He held everybody, made everybody feel like you were somebody. The tailoring was absolutely excellent, and you could buy anything through Gieves, not only uniforms, but if you wanted an elephant delivered in Karachi, Mr. Gies would arrange it. And I can can tell you later some stories, Mr. Gies, because he knew, if you wanted to know where anybody was in the Navy, you'd go and you visited London when your ship came in, and you said, hey, where's HMCS so-and-so, or HMS so-and-so? And they'd say, well, just a minute, sir, and he'd disappear in the back room. He'd come out and say, well, I think she's operating out of Gibraltar. They knew because everybody kept writing in saying, send my uniform or my collars or whatever I need to this spot. And Mr. Gies must seem to know where all the ships in the Royal Navy were, or Canadian Navy, you know. They knew everything. A fantastic outfit. So my first introduction to them was swift and efficient, and within 2 days I had a uniform and felt like one of the boys.
Now we're... given, I gather, not individual treatment per se, but was everyone treated, did they march you in?
No, we were just told that I think we were about a week in London, they said, you know, you're required to join the training ship in Dartmouth, which is down on the, she was anchored in the Dart, on whatever the date was, this would be about April, I guess, of a given time, and... you were supposed to do everything else yourself. You went and got your uniforms fitted up, and we looked around London a bit, and then we climbed on a train and reported when we were told.
Now, did you have to provide your own accommodation in London at this time? Do you
No, that was the only thing we didn't provide.
That would be the
that Niobe? Was a, yeah, Niobe, yeah. Somebody Niobe. Was picking up the tab. We didn't have to find that. And Mr. Gies, of course, didn't demand any money for your uniform. You just automatically had an account. When you were, he said, well, we'll. In fact, my father was paying my tailor's bill because I wasn't getting on 25 cents a day. Mr. Gies wouldn't pay much uniform for that. So you were, your parents picked up the bill, as far as I remember.
Mr. Gies must have had himself quite a...
He had an outlet in Gibraltar and in the Far East and in Malta. And, of course, in all the three major naval ports in England, Portsmouth, the Plymouth, and Chatham.
And how would he just became the Queen's Navy's outfitter? Or
he is the... Well, he had been a naval... He was a naval tailor, and he had been a naval tailor since the uniform was invented. I've forgotten what the date is. He's got it over his store, over his shop today. Seventeen-something, rather. Just anyway, about historically, about the time they established a naval uniform, Mr. Gieves started cutting them. It's that old, and he's
and
still
so
cutting.
Everyone goes. I imagine the store is quite does quite well.
He turned out a particular type of uniform, superfine serge, which was different. On a Sunday parade, you could see the guys who didn't have Gieves' uniforms on, you know, and Mr. Gieves set the style. I mean, you know, the regulations was us, but Mr. Gieves turned out a uniform like that, and that's the way it was. And later in the Canadian Navy, we got bigger and lots of people didn't know about Gieves, it was quite extraordinary. You know, you get a uniform built here in Victoria, and it just wouldn't look, the tailor would follow the instructions exactly, but it didn't look like Mr. Gieves, and you could tell. You can tell.
That's incredible.
And he knew everything. You didn't have to. You didn't have to ask him. There was a great list of clothing you had to have, and he would run down it and say, "You don't want this. You don't want that. Don't want this. Don't want that." And he wouldn't supply these, and you'd get because the list wasn't up to date.
He knew what you really needed. So he let you place yourself in his hands. You got your new uniform. You must have felt awful proud, I guess.
Oh yes, we all looked in the mirror and said, "Gee, don't we look great?" You can imagine, there were about 10 Canadians in this group.
Now, this would be the Canadian cut of RN uniform, or would it be virtually...
Absolutely identical, except it had Canada flashes up here.
It's the only...
Wait a minute. No, it didn't have Canada flashes. The Canada flashes didn't come along until later.
So you had an RN uniform,
it looked
the only
exactly.
difference would be the hat, then, is that... Or
no, there was no difference. It looked exactly the same as every other... our neighbors. You couldn't tell a Canadian except the buttons. If you looked at the buttons on the uniform, it had Canada written on it, or Australia. And that's all. Then the flashes came along towards the end of the war, and we thought that was a dumb idea. But it was on, you know, the buttons alone. In fact, I have a photograph somewhere of a uniform taken as a midshipman.
Now, you've got this uniform. You're feeling all, you're, I guess, as proud as punch.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You're feeling quite good. You're on the train. You're on your way down to Dartmoor?
Dartmouth.
Dartmouth. Okay, let me get this correct. Dartmouth, England. And this would be at the Royal Naval College?
Yeah. Well, it was the first term. We joined this converted cruiser, which was the training ship called the Vindictive. We had hardly got in her and started our training when they grabbed her and took her back for full service. They landed all the training equipment that was in her, especially the navigation equipments and all the other special stuff that was in her, into a sort of training school in the Royal Naval College at Dartmouth. Although we weren't going to the college like the young 13-year-olds, mm-hmm. we were joined up with a mass of British public schoolboys, as they call them, all about 17 or 18, and lived in a separate barracks in a kind of makeshift, because they had we should have been in the training cruiser, but they halfway through my time, they changed it back into a real cruiser, and we finished our training on the edges of the River Dart, using the boats and the stuff that the Naval College.
What was the training like there now? What kind of things were you taught?
Very, 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 very rigorous. We, you know, that you started the crack of dawn, like any training, and we did a lot of boat work. And you did a seamanship, knots and splices, wires, ropes, all anchoring, all that, all the standard seamanship knowledge. You were given grounding in the weaponry, torpedoes, the principles of, you know, the torpedo, the gun, and then you started your navigation. That started your astronav. That's why you need spherical trig to get into the thing, so that you could jump straight into astronomical navigation. And that was about the three. Oh, and some administration and supply. It very much like is taught to every cadet in every nation.
Yeah, but this would be a real, I gather, an accelerated program.
Not particularly. Funnily enough, despite the war, they had cut the cadets' time from 1 year to 9 months.
Because 400 years of tradition, we're not going to be...
No, sir, and they, you know, this was you were a permanent naval officer, and you were not going to be rushed through this thing, and that, i.e., through the rest, you know, through the war, I had to serve my 2 years as a midshipman, despite the fact that I was handling more firepower as a midshipman than I did right up until I was a commander of a destroyer in a battleship. There was no accelerated promotion. They didn't say, because the war's here, you're going to put a stripe on you. You did your 9 months cadet time, 2 years midshipman, and then your sub-lieutenants, and then your 8 years of lieutenant. Didn't matter whether hell or high water came. There was none of this business of being a colonel at 24. You just because you were permanent force. Now, when the war ended, of course, all of those airmen were dropped down. But the Navy just, you stayed. That you had this form, you know. You had to do 8 years as a lieutenant, and then you became a lieutenant commander, and then you were selected after that. But before that, you had to do so long as a midshipman. And then your length of time as a sub-lieutenant depended on how well you did in the courses for midshipmen, which I've just described,
mm-hmm.
And you got seniority. So you could do as little as 12 months as a sub-lieutenant before being a lieutenant, or as long as 3 years, I think, roughly.
Yeah, so, that's not too bad when you consider, though, that that's a two-bar lieutenant we're talking about. We're not talking about the army lieutenant. We're talking about a two-bar.
You're talking about a lieutenant who was during the war were commanding most of the destroyers.
That's right.
And your age would be in the vicinity of lieutenant 23, I guess. You'd have done 2 years as a midshipman and an average of maybe 2 years as a sub. You'd done 4 years service before you got your lieutenancy, and then you had to do 8 years of time. Well, towards the end of that period of 8 years, you were then better than 12 years service, so you were a pretty clued up fellow. So you could see lieutenants, permanent force, that's, you know, straight stripers,
mm-hmm.
as against all those wavy guys who came in, came in yesterday. But they insisted, they adhered to the system right through the war.
Well, did you question this, or you thought this was fun? Just
I didn't join for the war. I joined for the Navy. The war just happened to be an incident in my career. I was as concerned, and that's what we thought of it. It was rigorous training, and you did a lot of boat work in that dart all through the winter, or the summer, or whatever it was. And let's see, I guess it was the summer of 40.
Now, would there be any jogging? Were people washed out, I guess, as they call it? Do you recall
at all? I don't recall anybody leaving, but I think they did wash out some. You remember there was quite a large number, probably about 150 cadets there.
Now, there was no differentiation because you were Canadian.
There were Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, all belonging to their own navies, and Indians. The Royal Indian Naval people, right. And except, of course, you would recognize and some Englishmen who joined the RIN, Royal Indian Navy, and then there were, Indians. And in fact, we had some Poles and some Free French towards the end as they came out of Europe who were down doing this training. All in English, of course. But it was still the permanent force way of going in. There was no different from my training than had I gone there in 37 or 38 or whatever, except we didn't sail around to those ports that they used to in the training ship and didn't have a good time. We were working all the time.
So I guess you missed out on the cruise.
You missed out on the cruise, but we got to... By September of 1940, the war was really beginning to hot up, and the first action I got into was, it was that the invasion... The great moment of September the 15th, 1940, when they were supposed to be invading England. I was still a cadet, just about to be filed out of the training system. And we were all stood to and told to defend Britain, of which I was issued a pair of a brown boiler suit, as we call it, overall, one of those ridiculous tin hats, and I was given a stripped Lewis gun, which is the thing that they used to have in an airplane, the round, sort of fat one you always see in pictures with a...
Water-cooled...
Air-cooled barrel, but a very fat-looking thing. Right. There's always a pair of them sitting on the top of a Spad, those pictures of those two things with the drums on top.
Mm-hmm.
This is a stripped Lewis, it was called. And a sort of pole, which we stuck in the ground and put the stripped Lewis on, that was anti-aircraft defense. We dug trenches along the mouth of the River Dart and were told to defend Britain.
Didn't that strike you as being...
Well, that's about the first time I did sort of complain, saying, this is not what I signed on for, particularly as people really thought the Germans were coming. I said, listen, I wouldn't think of this. So this went on for about 2 weeks.
But didn't it strike you that the equipment you had really wasn't going to repel too much?
We thought it was kind of... I was considered myself very lucky because I had this machine gun. The other guys only had Ross rifles, if you know what a Ross rifle
is.
A Ross rifle is, was straight out of the Boer War or something. The whole cadet college, from 13-year-olds up, were mustered and had their defense positions along the mouth of the Dart.
You didn't feel odd, though?
It's all part of the great... didn't I feel odd? I said, I don't think I wanted to be a soldier much. I was keen to get to sea by this time, so I thought this was an embuggerance. We were air attacked because I remember getting one of my first heavy pieces of punishment. We'd all rushed down the air raid shelter. This is before the invasion threat. The big air raid shelter, we all went down, and I already at that age had quite a fund of dirty songs. Another Canadian and I, called Lewis, an engineer, Ken Lewis, used to have a duet on some of the racier songs we'd picked up along the way, and we were busily singing this in an air raid shelter. I think it was the second air raid in the place, and we were hauled up and punished and given 12 days number 11.
What's 12 days number 11?
Well, 11 is you spend a lot of time with a pack and a rifle above your head, doubling around the parade ground. You had to get up an hour earlier than anybody else, and you had to scrub out the heads, and you had to do... Yeah, they made life pretty miserable for you in number 11. All your leave was stopped, of course. You couldn't go anywhere else, couldn't go out. At the end of the day, you had chores to do, So you That was my first punishment in the Navy, for singing dirty songs in air raid shelter, despite the fact that I argued for about a minute and a quarter or less, probably about 15 seconds, that, sir, I was only trying to keep up the morale of the rest of everybody else, to which the lieutenant commander, who seemed to be a tremendously powerful man and very senior, just said nonsense. wrote me out my first punishment.
A good deterrent, or...?
Well, yeah, I suppose one didn't sing... I didn't stop singing dirty songs, because I still... I ended up a career with them. They always made a career on dirty songs after that. Well, not dirty songs. They call them traditional songs, seafaring songs. Yes, it was like... It was... the war seemed to be miles away until September of 40, when we really thought the Germans were coming. The whole of the defense of that coast... The only big gun we had was a 3-pounder saluting gun, which is, you may have seen, an ancient one, with the rubber, kind of rubber arm hold, a 3-inch, or 3-pounder, I suppose, about a 2-inch gun, very small, and it was mounted on the back of a truck, and that was the sort of center of our mobile defense. Nobody thought it was funny, nobody thought it was, it seems a pantomime now. But everybody took it seriously. As I said, I wasn't very happy with this business of having to fend Britain from the shore, but it never occurred. We visualized us defending the cliffs along there and shooting down those dreadful Germans, and thought it was going to be great fun. We didn't think too deeply in those days. That's when, the end of my training, when they said, what ship would you like to go to? And we talked about this, a bunch of us. All the Canadians said they wanted to go to destroyers, because that's what the Canadians had. And I said, well, I want to go to two sorts of ships, submarines and battleships, because the Canadian Navy didn't have any. And if I became an expert in those things, I would then be a rare bird in the Navy and have a trade that nobody else did, and therefore bound to prosper. QED, because that's not the way it works at all. But so I asked gingerly about submarines, and they said, well, you can't become a submariner until after you've become a sub-lieutenant and have done all your basic executive training, and then you go off as a young lieutenant and learn to be a submariner. But battleships, they said, yes, the midshipmen can go to battleships. And most, of course, midshipmen, they just hated battleships. Nobody wanted to go at all, except Lear, who said, I'm going to go and learn about battleships. And they said, well, have you any particular choice? And I said, well, I want the best, I want the newest one made. I knew that the King George V class were just coming off the waves then. And I said, the KG-5 class is what I'd like.
Excuse me, sir, now were you added, who's asking now?
Oh,
now,
Royal
Navy, is the Royal
Navy,
Navy,
no.
Or what?
You saw nothing of the Canadians at all. You were paid by the RN, exactly the same as all RN officers were. You got until as a midshipman you got a little bit more money, but you got it exactly the same way. You had all your administration, you were governed by the then King's Regulations and Admiralty Instructions, KR and AI. Never saw a Canadian officer. In fact, the whole wasn't until after the war that I really came under any Canadian administration at all.
You weren't writing your MP for
yeah, never wouldn't know where it was. Never once went through Ottawa on the way to Halifax. Knew where it was. No, you were completely immersed in the RN, and that of course accounts for the particularly British type or RN oriented Navy we had for a decade after World War II. And of course there was nothing strange about this. This wasn't a product of the war. This system. This had been the system that all officers had been raised in throughout. Since we closed our own naval college in 1921. It was the standard method of being trained. So you usually, had it been peacetime, after you had finished your midshipman's time, you were usually then returned to the Canadian Navy as a fully trained sub-lieutenant. Because that never occurred in war, you just went from one ship to another like everybody else.
You're a midshipman.
I'm now rated to a midshipman, which is a big promotion. Doesn't sound like much, but you went from 25 cents a day to $2 a day.
Right.
And that was big money in England for an officer at that time.
But this is coming from the RN. Now, the Canadian Navy, the RN?
Oh, the RN is getting its money from Ottawa. But they are paying it, you got paid
By the month. In scale. There's a difference in scale between Canadian forces and British forces.
Oh, yes, that's true. You were paid in pounds, shillings, and pence, the Canadian equivalent.
But were you given it all, or was some held back for you in Canada?
No, you were given it all.
No, so no dissension amongst your colleagues?
They're always saying, we were always having to buy the drinks because they said the rich Canadians get so much money. hadn't changed much. And it's a system still used now. If you are seconded to a foreign navy, you get paid by that navy the sum that's been agreed between the two navies. They say, his pay is this, but you draw it. You don't get an envelope all the way from Ottawa with a check because it's no good to you. You can't.
What I was wondering was the fact that I could see that as a midshipman. I'm not sure on your midshipman's pay, but I've been told by others, like in the RCAF, who are stationed with the RAF, that as a flight officer, whatever, they were making the same as squadron leader type of thing, and that caused a bit of problem. Then their pay was held up.
They did later in when there was enough pay to hold up. they later did withhold the pay for Canadian forces.
Yeah.
I was incarcerated at that time. Wasn't getting paid anything. But the pay was so minuscule in this $2 a day, which was considered to be a tremendous sum, 8 shillings, then when the rest of our guys were getting 5, I think it wasn't all that much, but 5 shillings a day. When you were getting a you weren't allowed to drink gin, but a glass of gin cost a penny and a half in the wardrooms, and a glass of sherry is very expensive. It costs 3 pence. So you could do quite well on $8 bob a month.
Well, weren't you under specific regulations? Were you allowed to hang around the wardroom and have a drink?
You must recognize, of course, that in vessels that carried midshipmen, there was a gunroom. There was a warrant officer's mess. There were sort of four messes or four grades of people in the in a cruiser or a battleship. There's big ships, all barracks. There was the mess deck and there was the wardroom, mm-hmm. and then in between there was the warrant officer's mess, which were the commissioned warrant officers, that were the thin stripe mm-hmm. men commissioned to the officer right, and then the kids. The midshipmen, all living in the midshipmen, had a separate place called the gunroom, mm-hmm. and you slept in a midshipman's flat, which was not a cabin. It was just an open space, usually between the cabins, where you were allowed to sling your hammock, and you had a chest of drawers about the size of that desk, and that was your living accommodation. You slung your hammock over the top of your chest, or in the chest flat, as it was called. It was a flat, a space between the officers' cabins.
And you provided your own chest, Mike? No.
This is the chest was built into the ship.
Built into the ship.
So and you were issued a hammock, and so you spent your life as a midshipman in a hammock, just like the seaman.
Now, what would happen in the gunroom? Were you issued your tot of rum?
No, the gunroom was run by a powerful individual called the sub of the gunroom. It was a sub lieutenant. And he had practically life and death control over his midshipmen. And you were allowed no spirits, just wines and beers. Mm-hmm. And you bought it by chit. You signed a chit, just like exactly the same. You ran exactly the same as a wardroom. Mm-hmm. And there was a wine book kept, and you weren't supposed to drink more than whatever. Forgotten what it was. 10 shillings a month was the maximum wine bill. If you went over that, the sub said, "Hey." Unless you, of course, said, "Well, that was specially for you, sir," and you called him sir. I mean, that was the drink I gave you, or you could fiddle at something like that, in which case he would let you go over a pound or two if you had a birthday or something, a shilling or two if you had a birthday or there was a big party. Very vigorous and controlled business. This sub-lieutenant being, all of a year older.
Yeah.
But he wore a stripe, and so he was a commissioned officer, and he was a wheel. And he had the powers to beat. He used to beat the midshipman on the backside as a punishment, meted out by the man who ran the midshipman, was called the Snotty's Nurse, and was a lieutenant commander. And this is in battleships and cruisers, where you were carrying... Sometimes, when I joined the Nelson, there were better than 30 midshipmen in her. In the Prince of Wales, we averaged between 12 and 15, but Nelson was absolutely rammed with them. I don't know why. But... The training, you're still under training at the Midshipman, and your training was being monitored and looked after by an officer called the Snotty's Nurse, who was usually an older lieutenant commander in the ship, or lieutenant, and he was your sort of divisional officer, and he trained you, and saw that you did this, that, and the other thing, and every time you got into trouble, he dealt with you. And he had the powers to order beatings in those days.
And
canings. Yeah, and some lieutenant usually did it. I remember being ordered to take a caning for doing something stupid, and I refused to take the caning from this guy who was a little bit smaller than me, and it caused quite a kerfuffle. Eventually the commander said, I said, I refuse to be caned. If anybody lays a cane across my backside, I shall bang him right in the eyeball. And they said, well, these odd Canadians, and they never did. I refused to have my backside beaten. I thought I was a bigger boy than that. It happened just once in the Prince of Wales, and I refused to be beaten and threatened to beat up the sub-lieutenant if he did, which is very ungentlemanly, but he didn't go any further. So that was the organization in this mm-hmm. huge community in a battleship.
Well, these ships are just absolutely immense, is that correct?
Well, immense, no. In size, when you take a look at a big aircraft carrier today, you are looking at an enormous size
yes.
ship, but the battleship was not so big in length as massive in the equipment. The built round the gun. I mean, the gun was the measure of the ship. You know, as the gun got bigger, the ship got bigger.
Right.
So the size of the battleship was predicated on the guns you want to put in it. So the original Nelson, had she been built with her original 16 inch. Instead of being cut down to 9 by the Washington Treaty, she would have been a huge machine. They had around 1,600. And Prince Wales had 1,400 officers and men in her. And 80 officers, of that, 80 officers, the wardroom consisted of 80 officers and about 12, 15 midshipmen. She had the biggest turrets that I think the biggest turrets ever built by any nation. She had these four guns all in one turret, the 14-inch four-gun turret, and I think they were even heavier than the Yamamoto's 18-inch, because she only had three of them in a turret, though nobody really saw much of the Yamamoto. That's the big 18-inch battleship. But they were certainly bigger than any other nation fighting outside of Japan. Simply in size, the turret weighed nearly 3,000 tons with its four guns in it. You can see one on the picture up there.
Yeah.
The whole thing, like a modern carrier today, although the carrier is different because the airplanes fly away and take a lot of the personnel with them.
Yeah.
But in a battleship, it's probably the biggest group of guys who live forever, you know, inside this regular sort of city.
Well, you're coming down to go now. The first ship you were on was the HMS Nelson?
Yes, I joined Nelson as my first battleship.
And this is a battleship. This is not a cruiser.
No, this was a
full-fledged battleship.
Mm.
HMS Nelson, and it's the King George V class.
No, that was the Nelson and Rodney were class of their own.
Class of their own. Nelson and